From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Tower, starring a refreshed, ready, and hopefully rested Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking Virginia politics with an upcoming election. We'll talk with Stephen Farnsworth, a professor of political science and international affairs. We'll also talk with Maryland State Senator Will Smith about Montgomery County and what's going on in the state legislature generally. Joining us now first, however, is Robert White, an at-large member of the D.C. Council, who has announced his presidency or his candidacy for mayor of the District of Columbia. He had made that announcement this week. Councilmember White, thank you for joining us. I may have elevated you to running for president, but that's not what you're running for.
That's right. Thank you for having me, Kojo and Tom. I'm really excited to be in this race for mayor.
At least you're not running for president yet. Robert White, Tom Sherwood broke the news last week that you were going to run for D.C. mayor in 2022. And, of course, he was right. You announced this week. Why are you running for mayor?
Well, Tom and Kojo, so many of us, you know, as we've been through the pandemic in these past 19 months, one of the things that we have seen is such a disparity between people who have been able to access resources and those who can't. And it has tracked so much with what we saw before the pandemic, the gaps in education and job opportunities and community development. And we are at a time now where after the pandemic and the racial justice uprising, things have changed in our city and leadership needs to change as well. So I knew that it was time for a new voice, and I had an opportunity to step up. And I've been honestly really, really humbled by the amount of support that we've gotten already, not just from people who have been with me in the past, but from so many new people. So I'm excited. Couldn't have predicted this kind of momentum in just a few days, but I do recognize where it's coming from.
I'm sure.
Welcome to the program. Welcome to the campaign. I know you're here just for a couple of minutes today, so I'm going to save a lot of questions till you come back for a longer period. But I did talk to some of the people in Mayor Bowser's administration and community leaders that I know and respect, and I want to just raise one serious issue with you. And that's crime. And I want to try to say this as quickly as possible. On violent crime, you have been saying for a couple of years now that you want to get at the root causes of crime, social, educational, racial discrimination, and so on. Many people agree with you. All of that needs to be done. But on the other hand, some people have criticized you for voting to curb hiring in the police department. And on this program, October 1st, Police Chief Robert Conti, asked about the council, said he is, quote, sounding the alarm that the police are down almost 300 officers. And he says, we can't do our job. We'll do the best we can. Let me just ask you, with all the long-term things you want to do to eliminate crime or reduce it significantly, what do you tell the grandmother right now who's sitting or can't sit on her porch because of the violence on the streets of Washington where she lives? What does that grandmother have to think about while you deal with long-term plans? What would you do right now if you were, in fact, mayor?
Well, Tom, I would tell that grandmother first that I hear her. I grew up here in D.C. in the 80s and 90s when we saw some of the highest incidents of crime, and I felt it and saw it personally. But I would also tell that grandmother that I know that we have a public safety responsibility right now. And so this is a both and. In the 80s and 90s, we took very much a just police approach. And there is a need for police in public safety. But we also do have to address the broader, more systemic right. public health issue. And our approach has to address both of those.
Then what is your short-term plan for police that you cut? The chief says that you've cut, you and the council, not you, the council has reduced policing when we need policing because of the 20-year rise in homicides in the nation. But right here in the district, homicides are way up. And so what would you do if you were mayor right now?
What I want to make sure we don't do is don't kind of politicize the issue, because public safety is
you don't
such
want to politicize crime
and real issue. This is very serious, right? And so we have increased the number of police, but we also have increased the number of violence intervention.
Yes, those
people.
Are all good.
We also have yes, and so we have to increase both, and that's what has happened. So, you know, we kind of get into this back and forth, you know, you did this and you know you didn't fund that, and the reality is we need both of these.
Okay,
it
doesn't mean just we have
when
to
they're saying they don't feel safe, we have to hear them.
Okay. Let me just summarize this. Are you comfortable now? The chief is not comfortable with the police force 300 officers down. Are you comfortable with the police force as it stands now in terms of numbers?
The problem with the police force is not the numbers. The problem with the police force is that we are calling them to do too many things that are not public safety related. And so we can't keep saying, well, we need to have more police and more police. But then the agency is a catch-all for all of these things are not public safety related. And so we have a real opportunity to make sure our police force is actually focused on public safety, not everything under the sun. And when we do that, I think we will see the number of police in a different way. But again, you know, police just can't be the only answer. They're part of, they are a large part of our crime response, but we have to be focused on crime prevention.
Well, allow me to throw three other issues at you to see if we can answer them. You can answer them quickly and we can move on. First, you mentioned the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, DCRA. We've been hearing complaints about that department for decades. The council wanted to split it up. The mayor doesn't. Would you split it up?
I would split it up, but the functioning of DCRA, and we're seeing some of this, we're seeing many of our agencies really kind of their systems starting to show their age. And, you know, at some point, we've really got to dig deep and start making government function better. And that's going to require some real work. But yes, I would split up DCRA, but there's a lot more systemic work that we have to do.
What are you
going to
do
agencies.
With the Department of Employment Services to improve its efficiency?
Well, I mean, that's the same thing as DCRA, Department of Employment Services. We have some issues in our construction agencies as well. We haven't really reformed the systems of government since Mayor Williams. And again, that's why I say these systems are really starting to show their age. We've reached a point in our city's trajectory where we need a leader who's really going to dig deep on those issues. So
okay.
We have a lot of work to do in our agencies. And I don't want to just call out two. Those are two that come to a lot.
One more, a Twitter message from
problems
one more, a Twitter message from Santi and a phone call from Kim that I won't take because it's addressing the same issue. Could you please ask the council member what he would do specifically different from Mayor Bowser to combat the affordable housing crisis in the district?
I appreciate that question. Affordable housing is one of the most essential issues that we're dealing with right now. A few things. We have to think outside the box. First of all, many people saw the Inspector General report. We are wasting a lot of money that should be going toward affordable housing. And we can't waste a dollar, much less $83 million. But I've also taken some very different approaches to affordable housing. I introduced and just got funded a bill that would allow the government to purchase covenants on existing units so that we can develop affordable housing units very, very quickly. I've been pushing an idea to convert older office buildings into residential with a focus on workforce and affordable housing. I have another bill that encourages seniors to open up extra bedrooms in their homes to other seniors. And so it's an outside of the box approach, but within the programs that we have now, they have to function the way we need them to. And that requires a high level of accountability inside our government.
Okay, you're just starting out, so you have time to put meat on the bones on some of these programs. So that was the most specific you've been. I look forward to your crime prevention plan for people who are stuck in their homes right now.
Robert White, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much. And hello to my friend, Senator Will Smith.
He's joining us momentarily. Robert White is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He has announced his candidacy for mayor of the District of Columbia. Joining us now, as Robert White said, is Will Smith, Maryland State Senator representing District 20 in Montgomery County. Senator Smith, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. Good afternoon, everyone.
And if you have questions or comments for the senator, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email at kojo@wamu.org or tweet at Politics Hour, or you can reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour. And Tom Sherwood, I know Senator Smith will be interested in this because this is an issue in which he is in a way invested. But this happened in Alexandria, where the city council has voted to return police to the city's public schools, at least through June. They had voted earlier to remove these so-called SRO, school resource officers, from the schools themselves. But after several incidents happened in the city, they voted to restore so-called SROs. Tom Sherwood.
Yes, the Alexandria took a vote 5 months ago, but the mayor, who voted against taking the SROs out of the schools, the school superintendent, Gregory Hutchings, the school board chair, Megan Alderton, all came before the council in a six-hour hearing and said, we understand we don't want the police running around the schools, but we need the police officers at our high school and our three middle schools. It's only five officers, and they said they would work on longer-term plans to maybe not have armed officers in and around the schools, maybe some people with better training. But they said this idea that, well, let's just get the police out of the schools is not working.
And in Montgomery County, Senator Smith, there is a similar law as the one in Alexandria, taking school resource officers out of schools directly. How do you feel about this issue?
Well, sure. Well, Tom, welcome back. And
Thank you.
I didn't get a chance to sit down with Robert White, but he's a good friend, and I wish him all the best. He's a good man. So what happened in Alexandria also happened in Montgomery County recently. There was another incident that had made some kind of statewide attention with an incident of violence. I'm on record, and I do believe that SROs, we should have, police should not be within the four walls of our schools. Now, that doesn't mean that law enforcement officers can't be close by to respond to a situation that can quickly escalate to secure the scene and to make sure that everyone's safe. That's my personal view. I'm pretty consistent on that, pretty public on that. But that doesn't mean that within our state, we have 24 jurisdictions in Maryland, and you know, I sit on the Judicial Proceedings Committee, I'm the chair of that committee, and we hear testimony from all across the state. So for instance, in Hartford or Baltimore County, people consistently come down and say, look, the SROs win SRO of the year, it's a positive experience for the students, it's not only an element of safety, but it's the first interaction with positive law enforcement community building. And so the testimony varies from jurisdiction. So I will cede you that. Here in Montgomery County, the county council stepped up and said, look, we're not going to have SROs in our schools, but we'll have those law enforcement officers at the ready, stand by, close by to a police, to a school. So if something happens, they're able to respond in an adequate manner. So I know some officials may go back and forth with this. I'm pretty consistent that I think that we have, if we invest in counselors and other ways to address that, you know, violence in schools, I think that's ultimately the better solution. But I understand that it's a divisive topic.
Well, Governor Larry Hogan is not going back and forth. Today he announced a refund the police proposal that would give $150 million to state and local police agencies. You mentioned that you are the head of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee. What do you think about this proposal?
So I applaud the investment in public safety. I applaud the investment in attracting and retaining the best and brightest law enforcement officers. But I decry the rhetoric that pits investment in law enforcement and public safety against transparency and accountability measures that are going to bridge that gap and restore trust between police and the communities that they serve. You're the governor of Maryland. You have an opportunity. If you're genuinely interested in solving problems, get rid of the rhetoric and just focus in on the nuance. And I said, you know, in a tweet back to his tweet, look, this problem set, this issue cannot be viewed through a binary lens.
Right.
You've got to acknowledge both sides. And you got a little bit into that with Robert White. We can invest in law enforcement. We can invest in public safety measures, which include violence interruption programs. But you also have to have a long-term view, which is those community building programs, those wraparound services, investments in education, transportation, and the like. Those solutions don't bear immediate political fruit. And that's where you have the problem with policymaking and politics. I really, you know, surprise on me, but, you know, there are politics and politics. But I just really wish that the governor really missed an opportunity to have a real candid, precise policy discussion on violent crime in Maryland in Baltimore City, absent the rhetoric, and he missed it.
Senator, I think Robert White said it's a both and problem. It's not no police or no long-term reforms. Both have to be done because citizens are worried now, whether in schools or at homes, and you have to do the long-term work. Let me just say, it seems to me overall, whether we're talking about the person who's being elected, the chief, the former police officer who's being elected chief, mayor of New York, which whether Minneapolis has keeping its police chief because he's tough on law and order and other things like that, that we're seeing a weakening of the anti-police sentiment here and around the nation as violent crime rises. Homicides in the country are 20-year high now. And that's the issue for politicians, particularly Democrats. Like last year and the year before, the defund police took off on the conservative side, and a lot of Democrats had said, "No, we're not defunding police; we're reforming police." But do you sense that there may be there's a weakening of the anti-police sentiment?
Absolutely, but just in Maryland, the discussion that I guided through our committee was never an anti-police kind of bent or sentiment to it. I never said defund the police. In fact, I always applauded and lauded the public service that they render every single day. And so for us, it was basically keeping on that line of, look, you can have both and understanding that, look, we have to have tough discussions as well with, you have to hold repeat violent offenders accountable. You know, that's not exactly the most popular subject within certain progressive circles. But also, you've got to expose certain records and track records of law enforcement officers that have a history of and a propensity of police brutality. That's not an acceptable or a popular line of discussion or argument within certain segments on the right. And you have to have both. And it ultimately, it's up to the policymakers to sit through both sides and make the best decisions on behalf of Marylanders. And that's, I think, what we did. We got pretty close to that last General Assembly session. But look, you're going to have some of those tough conversations about prosecution and about holding people responsible for their actions.
Yeah, I watched your
company with opportunity.
I watched the gun violence panel you did on October 12th, and that's the point you were making. It's a comprehensive approach to crime, including a better, not more police, but better policing. Let me just ask you about the big news in Maryland politics this week, though. Your good friend Nancy Navarro, 3-term council member in Montgomery County, was picked as their running mate, Lieutenant Governor, for Rashern Baker, the former Prince George's County executive who's running. And this has been, a little bit of a setback for Tom Perez and Doug Gansler and Peter Francho, all candidates for governor, all from Montgomery County. And Nancy Navarro is quite the get. What do you think? I'm not asking you to endorse, but what do you think about Nancy Navarro?
How do you know that Nancy Navarro is his good friend?
We are good friends.
Yeah, you tell me
and
she's not.
And you missed
not.
John King. John King's from Montgomery County. I've got three constituents running for governor from Silver Spring and Tacoma Park.
But Nancy Navarro.
Francho, Perez, and King. Nancy Navarro, she's great. I mean, she's got a really compelling story. She's a trailblazer, has done some fantastic things for the county, a huge get for Rashern Baker. And Rashern Baker obviously led Prince George's County through some great years of reform and has a stellar track record. So that's a force to reckon with. I think the entire Democratic field were blessed to have a wealth of riches. And we had a forum just last night, the Black Caucus did.
Did you go to that?
I was actually billing hours and working on a brief, but I had it streaming in the background. So I listened to every second of it. And I think every Democrat was there. We were blessed with riches. And I think two of the three Republicans were there. Dan Cox, Robin Ficker, and Kelly Schultz was noticeably absent. But it was a great debate, and I thought it was a really good showcase of talent that we have in the Democratic primary.
And one last thing, did you go to the J. Millard Taw's Clam Bake and Crab Feast this week?
You know, the pesky law job has kept me strapped to a desk, so I missed it this year. But I'll make sure I get there the next year. I did talk to a number of people that went, though. It was a great event.
Always, it wasn't so hot.
It was in the fall this time, better weather.
Robert White just mentioned, decided to file papers to run for mayor of the District of Columbia, but we should mention that you are also running for re-election in 2022. We've seen on Twitter that you are already out campaigning. Do you have any significant opposition? How is it going so far?
It's going really well. Everyone's been really receptive on the doors. You know, no competition, announced competition yet, but you always run scared and you always want to make sure you take your message to the to your constituents and get the feedback. So just it's been good to hear what's on people's minds and get out in campaigns. It's been refreshing.
Can we speak briefly about COVID? The governor, sure. Something like 85% of the people in Maryland have had at least one COVID shot. And the state is leading the country in many respects on that. What is your own thought about vaccination? I know you, are you still a reserve lieutenant in the, or maybe you've been promoted in the Navy?
Lieutenant commander.
Lieutenant
yes.
commander. Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. The Navy is requiring all Navy people to be vaccinated by November 28th or reservists by December 28th. How is it going in your view? Is this a political issue about how Governor Hogan has handled COVID, or do you think he's doing okay?
No, look, you know, I was harsh on the governor with this rhetoric of police reform, but I'll applaud him here. Look, he's been very forward-thinking about the vaccines. In Montgomery County, I think we've done even better. We have 99% of residents that are older than 12 have received at least one dose. So we're leading the state and the nation here in Montgomery County. You know, we're doing well in Maryland. I think that hospitalizations are down compared to our kind of our winter peak, but there's still, I think, over 700 people are being treated in Maryland hospitals now. So we're not out of the woods on this. And just think, for the folks that are unvaccinated, just if you can, step aside and think about, you know, every hospital bed that a COVID patient is taking up is someone that can't get their elective surgery or an emergency surgery, like someone having chest pains that's going to sit in a waiting room, someone that has an appendix that's ruptured, someone that needs that health opportunity in that bed is going to be neglected because someone is sitting in there with COVID, and it was an entirely preventable thing. So I just, for everyone listening, get your vaccine, get your two shots, and let's get out of this.
The U.S. Senate confirmed Eric Barron as the next U.S. attorney from Maryland. He currently works at the law firm Whiteford, Taylor & Preston. He was also up until October 7th, a Maryland state delegate. What can you tell us about Barron as the pick for Maryland's U.S. attorney? Are you going to say this is another good friend of yours?
He actually is a very good friend of mine. And so we came in together.
You need to find some enemies. Okay, but go
ahead. Yeah, that's right. We were elected together in 2015, and we became fast friends. And I remember sitting with him for dinners and drinks, and our families got to know each other. And he's obviously a partner at a law firm, a former delegate, a former prosecutor. He's the head of the Maryland Bar Association. It's just like the credentials are through the roof. He's got the background. He's got the experience. On top of that, he's just a really good and decent human being. And so we are in Maryland. We're just really honored to have him in our service. It's a stellar pick.
If my good friend Kojo will let me, I have one more question.
Everybody's got friends today.
And this is a fairly serious question, but not directly related to you as state senator. You just got back 2 years ago from your military service in Afghanistan, where one of your job was to advise the government back then in intelligence and advice. I was just wondering, as a human being who was there as a military person, what did you think of the exit from Afghanistan? Did you have any friends who failed to get out or did get out? And your view of the withdrawal after 20 years of an investment by the America to set up a government that folded like a deck of cards.
It was tragic and just a very just sad situation. So look, when we pulled out, when I left Afghanistan, the first soldier who was not alive on September 11, 2001, landed in Bagram Air Force Base. And so that shows you how long we were there. And if you look at the constitution that we built, that we helped them build and craft, it's the most progressive, radically inclusive constitution in Southeast Asia, a parity for ethnic minorities, women. A third of women were in parliament. Women were reporters, Olympians, professors, academics, journalists. So it was a very tragic and sad thing to see. Our mission there was a counter-terrorism mission, and it morphed into a counterinsurgency and a nation-building mission. And that's something that I think over time became untenable over the course of two decades. And yes, the answer to your question is I did have friends that were left behind, and I remember WhatsApping them, and you know, a quote from someone that I worked very close with, an Afghan, just said, I'm lost. I don't know what to do. I have young children. We bonded because I missed my daughter's first birthday while I was over there, but he had just had a daughter when I got there. And so we bonded over being relatively new dads. and to think about his family and his wife and his child stuck there under Taliban rule is nothing short of tragic for the folks that put their lives on the line to help American service members accomplish our mission of keeping our homeland safe. Very tragic.
Only have about 20 seconds left. Are you supporting anyone in the Montgomery County executive race?
No, I have not publicly announced.
They're all good friends.
They're all great friends. Two folks in particular that I'm close with, okay. I'll say, are good friends. Look, the current county executive doing some good work with COVID and getting our economy open.
Senator Tom Hucker is also
a good guy.
Thank you very much for joining us. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking Virginia politics with Stephen Farnsworth. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back. Joining us now is Stephen Farnsworth, a professor of political science and international affairs and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington. Stephen Farnsworth, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, and hello to you both.
We'll be talking Virginia politics. Stephen Farnsworth, a poll from University Mary Washington last month showed the Virginia governor's race very tight. It showed Republican Glenn Youngkin leading Democrat Terry McAuliffe among likely voters, 43%. Among registered voters, that flipped. 46% support McAuliffe, 41% support Youngkin. But why is this race so close?
Well, this is really an environment where Virginia Democrats always have to work harder the year after a presidential election. There's a much higher level of turnout during a presidential election year. And when you look at the year after, sometimes there isn't the kind of enthusiasm that you saw. I think in many ways, the Virginia Democrats in some ways may be missing Trump now that he's gone, because he was a very useful foil for them to run against during those years he was president.
McAuliffe still seems to be running against him, according to the commercials that I've been seeing. But go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say, but now, of course, with what's happened in the last few days, the president, former president, has tried to inject himself more into politics in Virginia, and that's going to give McAuliffe exactly the opportunity to focus even more on what he can do to make Youngkin and Trump running mates.
Yeah, we're in the last 3 weeks of this campaign. Voting's already occurred. I mean, you just summarize it really on the Democratic side. It's Trump, Trump, Trump. And on the other side, it's Glenn Youngkin has seized on the September 28th remark at the debate where Terry McAuliffe was talking about disruptive parents in Loudoun County and other places, but foolishly, in my view, said, I'm not going to let parents come into schools and actually take books out and make their own decisions. I don't think parents should be telling schools what they teach. And Glenn Youngkin is like a dog on a bone with that, with ads. So we're going to hear parents, 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 and Trump, Trump, Trump. Obama's coming into the state, I think in 2 weeks, a week before the election or so, to campaign for Terry McAuliffe. I'm just thinking, knowing Trump's behavior, he's not going to be upstaged by Obama. He wants to come into the state and campaign for Youngkin, even though that is the last thing Youngkin wants.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the best thing for Youngkin would be for Trump to fade into the woodwork for the next 3 weeks, but it's clear that's not going to happen. And that's the kind of strategy that I think that the McAuliffe campaign had been hoping for all along. You can see how quickly they have out now insurrection parody yard signs for the Youngkin campaign.
Yeah, this week, that event where Stephen Bannon, who's identified with Trump, and Amanda Chase, the state Republican senator who's Trump in heels in her own description, they held this thing where they all near Richmond, where they all saluted and did the Pledge of Allegiance to American flag that was at the January 6th riot. And Youngkin was forced to say that was a bad thing.
Yeah, the Youngkin campaign really has to walk a tightrope here. You can't win without Trump voters, so you can't really turn on Trump in any substantial way. And this is why you see something along the lines of the half measures that that Youngkin has in response, talking about this being weird and strange, this event that he did not attend. But on the other hand, the more the conversation is about Trump, the more Youngkin is tied to Trump, the worse that is for those sliver of swing voters who are going to maybe have been Romney Republicans in the past, McCain Republicans in the past, but not Trump voters. And so the closer those two men, the former president and the gubernatorial candidate, are tied together, the worse that's going to be for Youngkin.
But if Virginia is supposed to be considered a bellwether state, looking at the 2022 elections, this is a state that Biden beat Trump by, I guess, more than 10 points in. So what does this virtually tied race now say about where American voters in general are at this point in time?
Well, I think it says that people are really angry and confused. In our poll at Mary Washington, we really did see an awful lot of frustration with a whole bunch of things. People aren't unhappy with the president. They're unhappy with the former president. They're unhappy with the candidates. They're unhappy with the state of COVID. All these issues, I think, are creating an angry electorate that doesn't really feel great about anyone or anything. And, you know, that's, I think, the nature of a once-in-a-century lockdown. This is a healthcare crisis, an economic crisis, something that we haven't seen in such a long time. You have to go back 80 years, I think, to find something comparable.
It is different. My good friend Kojo mentioned your polling, your university polling, but all the polls have been running, and basically that's the only one that's shown, I think, McAuliffe behind. But it is close, and it makes me think, though, even 4 years ago when Ralph Northam was running against Ed Gillespie, the Republican, the polling was also tight, very tight then, and as you mentioned, Trump was still around, and the Democrats pulled it out pretty well. But it does seem to me that there are complacent Democrats who have won so much, maybe they don't feel as threatened, and it seems to make sense that Terry McAuliffe will beat the Trump drum until November 2nd.
Indeed, Stephen Farnsworth, what is turnout likely to be? Voter turnout is likely to be very key in this race. Is there any way to gauge turnout this year and what it might look like and what will influence turnout?
Well, it's really hard to do that because one of the big changes in Virginia this year compared to, say, 4 years ago is the dramatic ease of voting improvements that have taken place within Virginia. It is much easier to vote absentee and to vote earlier. There's a whole infrastructure that's been built in Virginia that has made it so much easier to participate. And so that is likely to suggest that ease of turnout, perhaps a higher turnout. But on the other hand, the polls and ours and others, all within the margin of error, are showing that there isn't the level of enthusiasm among voters that you've seen in the past. And so it's really hard to talk about this in any way that is not apples and oranges, because Virginia has made it easier to vote.
As you know, the Northern Virginia is the key to the Democrats. Northam carried some areas in the state 80 to 20, 60 to 40, very strong turnout, but some of the polling shows that McAuliffe is not drawing the same high level of support in Northern Virginia. He's going to win and win handily, but maybe not in the overwhelming numbers enough to turn back the rest of the red state, most of the red state.
And I think that's why you're seeing all hands on deck for the Democrats right now. You've got the president, the former President Obama. You've got the other politicians. Anyone that they can think of to bring into Virginia is going to be there. And, you know, the reality of this environment is that you have to really energize Northern Virginia if you're the Democrats, because the rural parts of the state are still motivated, still energized, still sympathetic to the Republican message, and that's going to create a significant advantage for the Republicans if it's not countered by the higher level turnout and a bigger partisan gap in Northern Virginia than what is suggested right now in the polling. Because although it does look like McAuliffe is ahead in Northern Virginia by a significant degree, the gap may not be as big as it was four years ago. And if that's the case, that's a big problem for Democrats.
Here's Rob in Arlington. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. Hey, Tom, welcome back. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, just a quick question. You know, I've already voted, big fan of Mr. McAuliffe. I guess my question for your guest is, it seemed like 8 years of really good things happening in Virginia between Mr. McAuliffe and Mr. Northam. I am shocked that it has become such a narrow race.
It's a tight race, yeah.
Very tight race. So I don't understand, and I'm wondering if our commentator could maybe weigh in what he thinks has made the gap close for the Republican guy, I don't even want to mention his name.
Glenn Youngkin.
That guy, yeah.
Widespread unhappiness is what Stephen Farnsworth is saying, but I allow him to respond, Stephen Farnsworth.
Well, that's right. And there's another factor, too. I think that the Republicans were wise to nominate Glenn Youngkin. If they had nominated a Trump acolyte, somebody who was 100% behind Trump, Amanda Chase was the most pro-Trump choice you could have made in that nomination. By choosing to build a system of nomination that favored Youngkin, and then Youngkin himself, he's got a resume that suggests that he's not part of the, if you will, the partisan trench warfare of the last 4 years in Washington and in Richmond. He's a new face, and Virginia is often sympathetic to new faces in politics. He has the opportunity to present a little bit of daylight, if you will, between Trump and Youngkin. And Youngkin has tried to do that. The problem is that gap is something that the Trump people are trying to close. And so the closer that Youngkin and Trump are in terms of the public minds, that's a significant problem. But Youngkin himself has tried to create that difference, and that's why I think there's been a significantly better polling numbers for Youngkin than for previous Republicans in statewide elections in Virginia.
The two big issues are COVID and abortion. On COVID, the clear distinction between McAuliffe and Youngkin is that McAuliffe wants mandatory vaccine rules for state employees, maybe others. Youngkin has said he wants everyone to be vaccinated, but it's a matter of personal choice if you want to, no matter what your circumstance is. On abortion, Winsome Sears, the lieutenant governor candidate for the Republicans, has said she wants the same tough anti-abortion law that Texas passed, where I think it's you can't have an abortion after 6 weeks, which is before some women even know they're pregnant. Glenn Youngkin has been caught on that tape, famous tape, telling people, well, he would be tougher about abortion or be more clear about it, but he needs independent voters. So are COVID and abortion issues that will affect the turnout?
Absolutely. I think that when you look at this election, both campaigns are really waging a campaign that says if the other side wins, it's going to be apocalyptic. You're going to see Texas-style abortions laws in Virginia, or you're going to see this sort of socialist nightmare. I mean, you've got your choice, right? You've got these extreme views. You run against what you want to run against. And so this is not an election that is focused on the good things that one candidate or the other would do for the state. This is much more focused on the bad things that would happen if the other side wins. The reason is because we know from all kinds of studies of politics, emotion and politics are a very powerful combination. Mm-hmm. If you can get people fearful, you are halfway there to getting them to show up to vote for you.
I tell students all the time, and journalism students, that campaigns are not about facts, they're about emotion. I'm glad you just said something similar. Let me tell you what I think is a sleeper issue in this. Princess Blanding is created a liberation party for herself. Black woman from, and she got on the ballot from Virginia suburb, Richmond suburbs. Her child was shot by police, so she's fairly well known down there. She's not well known up here, but she disrupted the debate, the last debate on September 28th. My thought is, if she gets 2 or 3% of the vote, and Winsome Sears on the Republican side, being a black woman, helps get a couple percentage black votes, that could be enough to switch the election to the Republicans.
That's absolutely true. In our poll, Princess Blanding came in at about 2%.
Right.
And that might, in a very close race, be the difference. You know, you don't have runoff voting in Virginia. You get to vote one time, and you pick one candidate, and if McAuliffe plus Blanding equals 50%, but McAuliffe on his own does not, there's a Republican governor.
Here now is Sue, who's in Virginia someplace. Sue, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm listening to you guys talk about the Virginia elections, and I just have to say, we are so enthusiastic about Terry. We have just put blanketing signs all over our neighborhood. We are sick and tired of being fear-based. This Youngkin man is a traitor like Trump. It needs to be emphasized that way, and Democrats need to get their act together and make sure Terry and Hala get into this race, because women do not want Republicans in Virginia or anywhere in our country.
Well, when you say we are fear-based, you sound as if you fear Republicans yourself. Are you both voting on the basis of fear?
Absolutely. Well, no. I like Terry McAuliffe and Hala. HALA, we did a fundraiser for HALA, and we raised in one night $22,000. So we have an engaged group of women in Northern Virginia. And yes, to tell you the truth, I live in fear almost every single day because of what is being spoken about Trump and all the Republicans and the disgusting things that they're doing. They are traitors to our country.
Stephen Farnsworth, does Terry McAuliffe and the Democrats in Virginia have a record of accomplishments that they can point to in this campaign? Or, as our caller Sue is pointing out, are most people basically voting on the basis of fear or what they're upset about?
You know, there was an old saying that all politics is local, but when we're looking at the Virginia election this year, it's almost as if all politics is national.
No transportation, no traffic here.
Right. Now, maybe that's a COVID impact. I mean, 66 and 95 aren't as bad as they usually are because more people are working from home, perhaps, although I've been stuck in plenty of traffic jams on 95. The reality, though, is that you're not seeing those conversations really playing all that prominent a role. People are not talking about transportation. They're not really talking about the gridlock and the transportation tax and those kinds of issues that are really key. If you look back to the last time the Republicans won the governor's race in Virginia, Bob McDonnell talked primarily about economic development, economic opportunity. It was much more an economic-focused issue about how to make Virginia stronger, and that's a successful message. But the reality that we're looking at right now is so little of a conversation about local issues.
That's because I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think really when we're looking at the environment here, it's really a national conversation. And that's one of the reasons why I think that you're looking at this as a sort of leading political indicator. Virginia, in many ways, is weighing in on the Biden presidency so far, whether the Trump presidency still motivates voters. These are the kinds of dynamics that are going to be a key issue.
Okay, well, on the economy, of course, inflation's starting to go up, but we're all on kind of a sugar high for all the federal money that flowed into our local governments. Let me ask you about the lieutenant governor's race. Sue mentioned HALA Ayala, who's from Prince William County, and she's running for lieutenant governor, and she's running against Winsome Sears, the Republican candidate. Whoever wins, there will be a woman as first lieutenant governor. It seems to me that HALA Ayala can help bring out the vote in Prince William County, and that will help Terry McAuliffe, when you generally think the lieutenant governor doesn't really have that much to say about elections. It's just the historic nature of it.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that one of the things that you see in this Democratic ticket is a very strong Northern Virginia presence. The Attorney General used to represent Western Fairfax and Loudoun when he was in the legislature.
Mark Herring,
in addition
right.
to Mark Herring. And then you have, of course, a former delegate, a current delegate, who's running for lieutenant governor from Prince William, and Terry McAuliffe from Northern Virginia as well. So you're looking at a very, very powerful dynamic designed to maximize that vote share in Northern Virginia that can favor the Democrats. But that being said, it also creates a vulnerability in other parts of the state, because normally when you try to balance a ticket, you also want to balance it geographically. And you want a lawmaker from Hampton Roads, say, for example, or from the Richmond area, as well as a Northern Virginia candidate. That would be sort of the optimal ticket. But it looks like this ticket is for the Democrats is all in on Northern Virginia. And whether that'll be a smart strategy or not, we'll know the day after the election.
Speaking of specific districts, we have a question from Mary in Leesburg, Virginia, about one such. Mary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo and Tom. Professor Farnsworth, I have two questions for you. Will Delegate Dave LaRocque's participation in the January 6th insurrection be the thing that finally causes him to lose his seat in the House of Delegates? And Republican legend Les Potts, who was state senator for 16 years, has made a stunning endorsement video for Democrat Paul Syker. What impact will this endorsement have on the race? Thanks.
Stephen Farnsworth.
Well, you know, I think one of the better campaigns out there was the campaign ad, Russ Potts, We Want Potts. And so I'll encourage people to go online and look at that video. He ran as an independent candidate for governor a while back. Mm-hmm. And so he has a significant influence with respect to those voters who are not automatically a Republican vote or automatically a Democratic vote. I think that that matters. But it's important to remember that what really matters the most in politics is the drawing of the lines, the district lines. And the LaRock, the district currently occupied by LaRock, is a district that was drawn to elect a Republican, and elect a Republican it has. We have to see whether that kind of motivation that we were talking about earlier in the program is going to create a huge upswing in Democratic turnout in this district in particular, because if enough Democrats show up and enough Republicans are dispirited, and Potts' endorsement can be part of this as well, you could imagine a more competitive election. But assuming ordinary conditions, I think that we have to look at this as a district that is drawn to elect a Republican likely to do so again.
We've heard a lot across the country about some parents being displeased with how schools have handled COVID-19, especially with reopening to in-person learning, mask requirements, and COVID-19 testing. What does that actually look like in Virginia? I know that this is something that you've researched.
Yeah, it's important to remember that the vast majority of people do not scream at school board meetings. The representative sample of Virginians that we looked at in our survey, and if you don't mind, I'll plug an opinion column that I co-authored with my student in the Washington Post last weekend that talked about how most Virginians were actually pretty happy with the way that their schools have handled the COVID restrictions. The people who are screaming at school board meetings in the Northern Virginia suburbs and elsewhere are not at all a representative sample. Most people think that the school districts have done just fine with respect to those health and safety measures that have been imposed in those school districts.
The same is true about critical race theory. But let me ask, before you leave the General Assembly, the legislature, all the delegate seats are up. There's 100 seats. The Democrats have only a 55-45, which means a 5 or 6 margin. Do you see the Democrats retaining control of the state house, that the state senate is not up in November?
Well, this is one of the areas where we really need to talk about the coattail effect really being essential. If Youngkin is elected governor, it's likely that he'll pick up several of those close seats, maybe even enough for the majority. If McAuliffe is elected, it's likely that he'll pick up enough of those close seats to retain the majority. And so, in many ways, it's the candidates for governor who are going to bring the voters in. And once they're there, my guess is they'll vote pretty much up and down the line on one party or the other. I think that we have very few people who are the so-called swing voters who might vote Republican in some races and Democratic in the others. And that just creates an environment where the tide will go in or it will go out.
And the same is true in the Attorney General race. It seems Delegate Jason Meares of Virginia Beach area is running for Attorney General of the Republicans, but he's virtually unknown in Northern Virginia against Mark Herring, who's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's important to remember that there is a huge, huge learning gap favoring an incumbent in a race like that. When you think about representing 1/100th of Virginia as a delegate would, you need to introduce yourself to so many people. And when you're an attorney general candidate, you may not get all that much attention. It's much easier to be at the top of the ticket. Then you're guaranteed a lot of attention.
Got a question about the poll itself from Brian in Arlington, Virginia. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'd like to find out from your guest just how many people were polled in this poll that he's talking about, because the population of Virginia is 8.6 million, and I don't think that asking 900 people what they think is very representative of anything.
Stephen Farnsworth.
The discussion seems to substitute these poll numbers for the real-life issues, and then you spend the next 25 minutes just talking about the poll numbers, which seems more to help the polling industry than it does to help voters. I'd like to hear the response.
Stephen Farnsworth, you only have about 40 seconds.
Well, I can't begin to talk about the nature of survey research in 40 seconds, but know this. This is a scientifically approved system that we routinely use that gives us our best guess of where the voters are. Election days are more important, of course, but our 1,000-person survey, which is the norm for all the other surveys as well in terms of polling size, gives us our best guess. And I think people sometimes like surveys if they like the outcome, and they don't like them if they don't like the outcome.
Stephen Farnsworth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Farnsworth is a professor of political science and international affairs at the University of Mary Washington. That's about all the time we have before we go. On Monday afternoon, I hope you can join me and the 1A host, Jen White, for a live call-in special about the Virginia elections. We'd like to know what's on your mind ahead of the election. What are the big issues driving you to vote? Who do you think should be the next governor of Virginia, and what should that person's priorities be? That will be Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. You can learn more at wamu.org/specials. Any big plans this weekend, Don?
I'm going to the reopening Hill Center on Capitol Hill Community Center, where there's going to be bluegrass on Sunday.
And where both and Tom beer. Sherwood and I and together have conducted discussions.
Yes. But they'll have beer at this one.
They'll have beer? Will you take one of your good friends with you, please? I'm not saying it should be me, but I'm just saying. Thank you all for listening and stay safe.
All good friends.
I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon, and our managing producer is Inga-Lisa Schrobsdorf. Today's engineer was Kellen Quigley, and our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's phone screener was Nancy Gaius. Mana Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.